Joe Sheehan.
I don't know if you read what Joe Sheehan wrote.
I did.
Baseball America, SI, and the Joe Sheehan newsletter.
Into right center, back of the warning track, the wall, it is gone!
He writes what Dan reads.
Reading is good.
Joe Sheehan with Bernstein and McKnight on the score.
And just as we heard Yu Darvish in his own words earlier, Joe Sheehan also doesn't need a translator, and you can hear him in his right now. He's on Twitter at @Joe_Sheehan, and he joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles to choose from. Hello, Joe. What's happening, man?
What's up, Dan? I'd be questioning that. There are people who told me they can't understand what I'm saying. So.
Well, I certainly understood this via Twitter that you just posted, but I want you to let us know why this is significant. 10% of the season is in the books. Hitters are putting up the best on-contact numbers ever. Home runs on contact, 5.23%. Best, a huge jump over 2017's 4.82. Slugging on contact is a best ever 565. Isolated power on contact, 237, best ever by 14 points. What the hell?
And you know, normally I'd be a small sample guy, but, you know, a couple of points. One, as Eno Saris pointed out a couple weeks ago, season level numbers, elite numbers stabilize a lot faster because you're talking about, you know, you're putting in 900 plate appearances a night. The other thing is that April is when we usually expect offense to be down. Now, granted, we've had better weather this April around baseball than we have in a lot of places, but in a lot of other Aprils. But realistically, you can expect these numbers to go up as the season moves on. And, you know, I kind of look at it as there's a lot of complaints, right? All the hitters can just slap the ball the other way to beat the pitchers and make more contact. But it's hard to look at these numbers and not see that what they're doing is working. They're, again, you look at these home run numbers, you look at these slugging numbers, and yes, some of it is the baseball. Rob Arthur had a piece the other day talking about how the baseball seems to be closer to what it was in 2017 in terms of air resistance and how far it's flying. If you just sit and watch games on a given night, man, you see a lot of balls flying out of ballparks. And I think that these numbers, what the hitters are doing on contact, justifies everything that they're doing at the plate in terms of selling out the power, you know, giving it for launch angle, trading contact for power.
Is it better?
Define better.
Better than what Rob Manfred would have you believe his sport is at right now.
Well, see, this is an interesting thing. So I'm of the opinion, and I Connor, I don't know how old you are. I'm 48. So I remember
33.
Like the eight. All right. So I apologize. I don't mean to say that. I don't mean to diminish you. But what I'm saying is, like, I have actual memories of baseball in the 1980s. And the thing about the 80s is that there was a variety of ways, approaches to win the game. You had, you know, teams like the Brewers or the Red Sox who would try to outslug you. And you had teams like the Royals and the Cardinals who would try to get on base and run. Mm-hmm. There were all of these different ways to play the game. And I think what we've lost in today's game, forget the aesthetics of it, is just there's just not a whole lot of ways to win. You pretty much have to strike guys out and hit home runs. And if you're not doing those things, you know, you just don't have a variety of approaches. And I think that's one of the things that's less interesting. Now, as far as the aesthetics of it, you know, there are smart people I respect, and I feel like this is the generation gap, which is why I asked how old you are, that if you don't remember a game where there was a lot more motion, a lot more first to third, a lot more defense, a lot more everything, you can just focus on the raw skills of these players, which are absolutely amazing. These are the best baseball players in human history, and just say, hey, this is exciting. You know, kind of, it's the difference between baseball through the center field camera and baseball from section 312. And I think that this is the dominant way of the game. And there are a lot of people who love this game. I love the talent on display. But as somebody who remembers a version of baseball that involved more than the pitcher, the batter, the catcher, and the umpire, I feel like we have lost something, yes.
We were reading a piece a couple of days ago about this, the, like you say, the sort of accepted way of, you know, hit home runs and strike people out. And yet, there are fewer fastballs being thrown than ever. We are seeing an adaptation to something here where these swings that are designed now that have responded to the uptick in velocity, that the next response has been fastballs, when thrown, are harder than ever indeed. They're just not being thrown as often. What's going to be the effect of this?
But we're seeing it. We're seeing more swings and misses. We're seeing more. One of the things we're seeing is more pop-ups. The pop-up rate has jumped over the last 2 years, certainly, in fact, year over year. which is driving down batting average on balls in play. The batting average on balls in play is the lowest. It's 294. It's the lowest since 1987.
Wow.
And we'll see where that number goes. There's, Dan, you mentioned that kind of the back and forth. One of the reasons I think, just thinking about it from, you know, standing in the box a zillion years ago, everything is off reaction time, right? You have to gear up to hit the hardest fastballs in baseball history. And all of those things make the breaking ball more effective. The decision point for hitters is earlier than it's ever been before because of the velocity. And on top of that, you have pitchers who are throwing the nastiest breaking stuff in baseball history. And this gets into some of the, you know, all of the technological changes in the game have really favored the pitchers. You talk about the Edgetronic and the Rapsodo and the way pitchers can kind of learn how to shape their pitches and maximize the spin on their breaking balls and get the right hand angle. Tom Verducci had a great piece in this in Sports Illustrated about 3 weeks ago. So pitchers, they're not just benefiting from the velocity. And yeah, they're, but because they know they can, or hitters know they can throw 93, 94 as a matter of course, adjusting to that nasty breaking stuff is that much harder.
We're seeing it in Chris Bryant, I think.
A little bit.
I'm looking at all the data. We've been looking at where he is now so kind of mixed up that not only is he making a lot of outs with non-competitive swings on changeups and breaking balls, he's now missing hittable fastballs in the zone. And I don't know if this is just a blip or if he's a perfect example of the kind of player to whom pitchers have adjusted.
And it's interesting. So you just go off the stat line. I mean, a strikeout rate of 20, looking at now, about 22% isn't actually that notable, right? You would look, but it's something that you get if you watch the player every day. You kind of say, okay, what is he missing? How is he reaching those strikeouts? And it's confusion. Now, what I would say is it's 15 games into the season. And Chris Bryant is enormously talented. And I really wouldn't be that concerned about him big picture. But if pitchers today can make Chris Bryant, one of the most naturally talented hitters in the game, look like that, think about what they're doing to the rest of the league.
One guy who's kind of changed a trend as it comes to strikeouts is Yoan Moncada on the south side. He had 85 strikeouts looking at last year. He has had none so far this season. That pace last year would put him for 9 already. He has completely changed the hitter. What do you make of such a radical adjustment?
You want to be, you're a patient hitter coming up to the minors. You're patient. And you kind of becomes, okay, how do you balance that? We've talked about this with Adam Dunn all the time. I remember going back and just, now I'm not trying to pull Chicago examples, but I remember when Frank Thomas used to take these for this, you know, take the pitches. It's a matter of finding that balance between being a patient, disciplined hitter who waits for his pitch and drives it and not being too patient. This is, when I talked about Moncada last year in his first full season, I was pretty much, hey, this is a guy who's 23. Even in what is not a great season, he's going to be a 2-3 win player. And it's just a matter of him adjusting to the major leagues. He was never going to strike out 200 times a year. That wasn't the type of hitter he was, because he wasn't flailing away. It was an approach to him. So it's a matter of gaining confidence in swinging at the marginal pitches you can drive and laying off the other ones. I love to see it, because I've been a Moncada honk ever since, well, because he was coming from the Red Sox in the system. And I still thought last year he had the ability to get the bat to the ball more than he has. Again, he's going to be a high strikeout hitter. He's going to strike out 140, 150 times a year. But 140, 150 times a year for the power that he's going to provide is nothing.
What does Tim Anderson's start mean to you?
Any hitter with his, we've always known, right? He's got the strength, the bat speed to be a productive hitter on contact. But I don't think he's necessarily changed fundamentally as a hitter. A 10-1 strikeout to walk ratio is still miserable. Mm. He's not, you know, we talk about Moncada, what about that being an approach difference. This isn't an approach difference. This is just the raw skills taking over. Any hitter who has Anderson's ability has the ability to go nuts for 50 at-bats, which is what we've seen here. I think this could end up being a peak season. You know, maybe this is the year about, you know, he gets 315, 320, but I think he's the same fundamental player that he's been. And in a totally different way than Moncada, even being a flawed player, he's still a very good one. That contract that they gave him a few years back is a fantastic deal. He's going to be a three-win player. He's a plus defender. He's plus on the bases, guys. What is he, 5-for-5 stealing so far this year?
I think so.
I compared him in the past to guys like Adam Jones, who are about as good as you can be without having much of an approach at the plate. And I still think Anderson has that kind of ability. I think Anderson's peak is going to be like a 4 to 5 win player. And now maybe you're seeing one of those seasons this year. I'd love to know what would have happened if they hadn't rushed into the majors. I feel like they rushed into the majors, gosh, what is it, 6 years ago now, it feels like? It's been a while. What would happen if Anderson had been allowed to kind of maybe develop an approach in the minors rather than being rushed. But for the player he is now, it's not somebody who's going to be one of the five best players on a championship team, but he's going to be part of that next group of players that really makes the team, puts the team over the top.
There are a couple in the National League that have been surprising to me. Christian Yelich, I know he won an MVP last year, but keeping up the home run rate is something a lot of people didn't think he could do, and he just keeps hitting them. And Cody Bellinger has absolutely been terrific to start the year. Either one of them more surprising to you than the other in terms of their performance this year?
Probably Yelich, because I was one of the people kind of saying, okay, you know, nobody's going. Remember, in the second half last year, half of his fly balls went for home runs. And that's just, Babe Ruth's big brother doesn't do that. And you come out this year, and it's not that the home run to fly ball rate hasn't regressed. It has. He doesn't have that same home run to fly ball rate, but he's shown that he can convert as a hitter. Guys, when he was with the Marlins, he was basically hitting fly balls about 20% of the time. That was what he did as a Marlin. And this year so far, he's hitting fly balls about twice that rate. And to see this kind of conversion as a hitter, you know, we talk about guys like J.D. Martinez, Justin Turner, Max Muncy, guys who kind of were, their career was going nowhere, and then they became launch angle guys, and they hit a bunch of home runs, and they became stars. Christian Yelich is an example of a player who was already a star. Christian Yelich was a 4 to 5 win player as an extreme ground ball hitter because he ran the bases, he played the position, he hit for average, he drew walks. He was a star who then said, oh, wait, I can hit the ball in the air more? And now this is what we're seeing this year. So this is a legitimate change in the player, whereas last year's second half was kind of, he hit more fly balls, but it was kind of a fluky homer to fly ball. This is, I'm a legitimate power hitter now in addition to all of the other things I used to do. It's really fascinating.
It's amazing. It reminds me of the conversation we had years ago with Jim Fry when he was talking about Ryan Sandberg. And he just noticed something in his swing. And he said, you know, you should try to pull the ball a lot more than you do, and you're going to hit a lot more home runs. And Sandberg just said, okay. And it took a guy who was always expected to be a very, very good player and turned him essentially into a Hall of Famer.
Right. I think about Charlie Morton a couple of years ago. Oh, wait, I can just decide to throw the ball harder? And, you know, now he's sitting on a $30 million contract. It's the deltas with players. I think that's one of the things that we're going to have to get used to now. We talk about, you know, player career paths, they get better, they peak around 27, and then they fall off, and that's changed a little bit. But now, players have the ability to change what they are, maybe more than in any time in baseball history. So we just don't know what these guys can become from year to year. As an analyst, it's going to be a little frustrating, but it's also going to be fascinating to see how these players make themselves better.
No, David Bote and the Cubs, we heard that story.
Yeah,
that he was hitting 108-mile-an-hour ground balls, and everybody in the Cubs organization saw all the data and said, yeah, we're going to change your swing plane if that's okay with you.
The American League version of that is Yandy Diaz, who the Rays picked up over the winter. Same thing. Incredible exit velocity, just needed to learn to elevate the ball.
Joe, appreciate it. Great talking to you, as always.
Thanks, fellas. Take care.
Always interesting times in baseball, made more interesting by the intellect of Joe Sheehan, who you hear on Tuesday. Remember, Tuesday is Joe Day on the Score. You get Joe Sheehan at 10, Joe Madden at noon. And the segment brought to you by the Chicago Dogs. They're in the news, too. Baseball, hot dogs, fireworks, baseball with everything. Tickets go on sale Thursday for the Chicago Dogs, your premier minor league baseball team. Opening day, May 17th, fans will receive an iconic hot dog costume and set a world record for the largest pack of wieners in one location. Purchase tickets at thechicagodogs.com. Hot dog.
Top notch.
We have a wiener.
Well done.
And we have the midway coming up.
What about
up?
The wiener?
I have a Florida man story that involves fun with adverbs and a death of a TV comedy icon that you may have never heard of.
I got a one-legged chase and a man dropping something on the street that I wish I could be carrying around something like this and just lose track of, but I don't have that kind of fortune. The Midday Midway is next. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel
the Midday Midway with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
We have reached the Midday Midway, the bottom of the hour brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Nothing beats playoff hockey in Chicago. Catch the Central Division champion Chicago Wolves. They battle Grand Rapids in the first round Friday and Saturday night at 7 at Allstate Arena. For playoff information, visit ChicagoWolves.com. We talked about the disturbing story, the developing story regarding MLB, the Cubs, and the Players Union investigating racist social media posts that were sent to Cubs pitcher Carl Edwards Jr. via Instagram. It sounds, just from the kind of language being used, the particular words and the tone, that it's something much more than garden variety insults. So we're waiting to find out more about that investigation, about what is happening. Also talked about the victories, respectively, for the Cubs and Sox last night. The performance of Yu Darvish, Yu Darvish's 98 miles an hour at the end of the game.
Yeah, now he's aired it out, yep. Just at the end.
And
a two-seamer now. Everything's fine.
And the White Sox got a nice hustle comeback win, a professional win. Involved some
Tim Anderson and Yoán Moncada. Yep. And, oh, man.
And some replays went their way.
Win or lose, Doc Rivers' postseason trip has already paid off. The Clippers head coach became the recipient of another good deed Monday after casually dropping $2,000 while roaming the streets of San Francisco.
Who carries that much cash? Who carries any cash?
I don't know. I've never had any cash on me. Ever. Ever. I was walking down the street, he said. True story. Reached into my pocket to grab my phone, and unbeknownst to me, I dropped about $2,000 on the street. Kept walking, didn't know. The guy tapped me on the back and said, "That's your money." I don't know a lot of places where that would happen. The unidentified hero ran off before Rivers could reward him with tickets to Game 2 against the Warriors that same night. As to why Rivers would dare carry that amount of cash, of course, chunk change compared to, it says chunk change. Is it a chump change?
Chump change.
It says chunk change. It's chump change. Yes. Even I know that one. Compared to the reported $11 million he made this season, it's unclear, and he wouldn't say why he was carrying $2,000 around. When I went to buy the condo last fall, and you have to carry that check into closing, and it's I'm not saying, but five figures, and that's, I didn't realize the nerves that I would go through when I mean
walking around the cashier's
check and they give you, then it's a bare, like, if you have it, it's yours.
No, you don't have to do it that way. You can do a certified check where it's made out to somebody.
I wish someone had told me that, because I had the one where if you're holding it, it's yours.
The negotiable bearer bonds.
And I felt
sitting
like
on a beach earning 20%.
Villain in a Bond movie. Yeah. And I mean, it was nerve-wracking. I walked three blocks from I found the closest bank to where I had to go. It was three blocks away, and I was terrified the entire time, and I had no idea what that was going to do to my nerves, and the whole day got thrown off.
If you get the chance, you should see the movie I helped make, a movie called Imperfections, that's about the diamond couriers in the Diamond District, the diamond wholesalers will pay...
Smuggle things inside of them?
No, they'll just pay young women to carry packets of diamonds around from place to place as need be, because nobody suspects that...
the Spanish Inquisition.
That too, the comfy pillow. That no one will expect an otherwise average-looking person to be carrying $250,000 worth of diamonds on them from place to place.
So much money.
And that's the plot of the movie, because they're in that there might be opportunity. Mm. Georgia Engel died. You know who that is?
I feel like I know the name. I've seen it posted on social media, but I don't know.
You totally know who Georgia Engel is. Multiple Emmy nominee. She was part of the Mary Tyler Moore Show from 1972 to 77. She was Ted Knight or Ted Baxter's wife on that show.
Of course.
She was Georgette Franklin Baxter, and that ended in 1977. She also has been here and there in various recurring guest roles. She was Robert Barone's mother-in-law on Everybody Loves Raymond. Her husband played by Fred Willard.
Oh.
And they were the the Protestant in-laws that were very wary of the Catholics.
Yeah.
And she always had wonderful comic timing. Really quiet, careful, clever. It's kind of like the glue to a comic scene that you don't realize it just quite how consistent and how good and how funny she was. But here's what's weird. First of all, how old do you think she was?
It feels like, to me, that show feels like forever ago. Like it feels like my mother watched that when she was a kid. So I don't 80 something.
She was only 70.
And she was playing opposite Ted Knight.
She was only 70.
What was the age difference between the two of them? It had to be something like 20 years.
Yeah, pretty significant, right? So here's what else is weird. They don't know a cause of death. Because she was a practicing Christian Scientist, says she did not consult doctors due to her religious beliefs.
That's a thing. I didn't realize that was a thing for
but
them.
But at what point are you not consulting doctors?
All points, apparently.
Right? So, like, are you not having checkups?
I guess. I mean, I haven't had a checkup in the better part of a decade, but that's
really?
Just, yeah, well, that's just me.
You're young enough.
I didn't have health insurance for a very long time.
Yeah, but you should
probably. And now don't really understand the process at all. I don't know what an HSA is or any of those things. I should really do some work on that.
Have a look over.
Just a once over.
How's your father?
Just give me a hand. Yeah, just turn, cough,
you know,
all those kind of things.
We old guys every couple years have to go in for the full workup, and that's just very strange. She lived to 70, but she didn't consult doctors. My advice to you is consult doctors in general.
Might have made it to 80.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. This from St. Louis. A woman who wanted a chocolate ice cream cone had a meltdown after employees at a St. Louis restaurant told her they only had vanilla last month.
Uh-oh.
She spit on workers and took a baseball bat to the windows of a Raleigh's restaurant in the Central West End after she was told they'd run out of chocolate.
Well, head down to Ted Drewy's in St. Louis. That's
early
the place.
March 27th, police say. She broke out the windows of the restaurant, according to authorities. She got into a vehicle and took off. They are still looking for her. What this story really did for me is, have you ever been to a Raleigh's?
I think so.
So I'm not sure if there's a Raleigh's Checkers. Like,
is it
there's a
drive-in?
Combini- yeah, it's like a, I mean, it's a burger spot.
It's like a Sonic.
There are restaurants where, well, it's not a drive-in at all places. Sometimes there are Raleigh's that you can go in and like just a general restaurant. That was the cheeseburger spot when we were living in Fort Wayne, Indiana, when I was a kid for a couple of years.
Not your Appleton place.
Appleton, not Tom's Drive-In,
okay,
where the middle schoolers are tattooing each other in the restaurant and have been booted out of the restaurant from here until eternity. No, Raleigh's, pretty decent cheeseburger. And I tell you, Rick's going to hate this. But Raleigh's is where I learned that on a cheeseburger, ketchup, mustard, and mayo as a combo in the right proportions, that's how you get it done.
You're right. I do hate that.
I know.
That's very gross.
I agree with you that it took me a while to
get
around.
In the right combo.
I had mayo on a burger from M Burger.
Mm.
And it was after a wedding, and they had arranged for, as guests were leaving, Emberger, people from Emberger walked in bearing Embergers as you left and to soak up all
that's
of your vodka.
That's a move is what that is.
Yeah, it was a great wedding.
And burgers on the way out the door?
On the way out the door.
Mm. But the M stands for mayo doesn't belong on your GD burger.
But here, just a little.
But here's the thing. And I saw there was lettuce and tomato, and I just said, you know what? They're handing this to me. I'm going to eat it.
You eat it.
And it was phenomenal.
It was
just a little
mayo. It's not the same proportion. Just a little bit of mayo,
you know,
ketchup, mustard on the burger.
Whopper.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's where you get it.
Whopper.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. A drunken Florida man was arrested outside Olive Garden after eating pasta in an inappropriate manner. Now, the headline, and I wasn't, the headline was compelling because it said, man arrested outside of Olive Garden after eating pasta belligerently.
Ah.
And I'm thinking, how does one do that?
Being very angry and throwing the pasta at people?
How does one eat pasta? No, it doesn't say throwing pasta.
And belligerent.
Eating, like demonstrating.
Well, there's a violence to belligerence.
A show of force in the way he was eating pasta. Well, here's what happened. According to the Miami Herald, officers with Naples Police Department were dispatched to Olive Garden 3:30 p.m. Sunday regarding a disturbance. A man was asking restaurant patrons for money, yelling at them using explicit language, and when police arrived, they discovered a shirtless man on a bench outside the establishment, allegedly shoveling spaghetti into his mouth with his hands. I don't know if that's belligerent or just messy.
Not yet.
Or efficient. The man, identified as 32-year-old Ben Padgett, was placed under arrest for disorderly intoxication. Before being placed in handcuffs, he was given a paper towel so he could wipe the pasta off his face. And while in the back of the police car, he began violently twisting his body, kicking his legs, and smashing his head against the metal cage partition.
Well, that's belligerent, then.
Went to Naples jail, center facing an additional charge of resisting an officer without violence, was released on a $2,000 bond, and he looks like a combination of Jesus Christ and Jay Cutler.
With pasta sauce all over
his face. But it is something.
Someone praising just says, whatever.
Don't care. Eating pasta insouciantly.
So every couple of weeks, I check in on the Jose Canseco Twitter feed because it's just a trip. And you'll remember a couple of months ago, made my check and wanted to update you on what he'd been up to on Twitter. Remember, this is when he was offering to his fans, really anybody, but his fans particularly, his offer was, come hunt Sasquatch with me.
Right.
And by the way, we'll find aliens too.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a fantastic trip through the insane. A couple of days ago, Jose Canseco tweeted out, Chris Davis from the Baltimore Orioles, let me help you with your swing and get back to that 50 home run play I told you where at also needed to help you with the psychology of the game, the psychology of a power hitter. That's verbatim from Jose, because that's the only way to read from Jose Canseco's Twitter feed. I don't know whether Jose and Chris Davis got together and talked, but Chris has since gotten a hit and a home run since that tweet happened. But this is the one that really caught my eye. Congratulations. This is from this morning. Congratulations, Tiger Woods. You're the man. I'm your biggest fan. Can you please come on my podcast, The Truth Hurts? I've also had 7 or 8 surgeries, can still head of soft butter 500 feet, and a golf ball over 380 yards. The man's a treasure. This website is free. You sign up and then you go follow the man, and it's crazy and it's free.
That's the Midday Midway. Zach Harper of The Athletic gives us the lowdown of the NBA playoffs and all the developing storylines. Next, keep it here. Bernstein and McKnight of The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
31-point lead by Golden State dissipated. Here's Thompson has to fire up a three, would not matter, and that will do it. A remarkable comeback. The L.A. Clippers on the Warriors court here at Oracle, down by as many as... The Clippers defeat the Warriors in a classic, 135-131.
It's not Marv swearing. That would be some celebratory players, I believe, whooping it up in the background. The segment brought to you by Patrick Cadillac. Let's talk a little NBA with Zach Harper. He is on Twitter at Talk Hoops, and he's on the Alpamonte Ford hotline. Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles to choose from. And we should mention that you can meet the very Zach Harper because his podcast, CountTheDings.com, is doing the Count the Dings live show here in Chicago, Saturday, May 18th at the awesome Lincoln Hall. Sounds like a fun time, Zach.
Oh, it's going to be a great time. We've done about 10 or 12 of these live shows over the last couple of years. They legitimately keep getting better because we actually know what to do now. And so it's a really fun way to kill, you know, hour and a half, 2 hours. Here's some sports, here's some culture, and a lot of inappropriate jokes that we can't say even on the podcast.
So what of this comeback from the Clippers? Down 31, they come all the way back to win the thing. Some pretty incredible performances from a number of them. I'm saddened by the loss of DeMarcus Cousins for what's going to be the rest of the season, but they don't seem to have him. They're the Warriors after all.
Yeah, they don't need him. And actually, you know, the pickup of Andrew Bogut becomes pretty prescient because that will fill the void in a lot of ways for them. Not that he can do what DeMarcus does, but he just shores up a lot of defensive stuff. He sets good screens. He moves the ball. Like they know how to play with him. I mostly just feel bad about it because DeMarcus was, you know, looking to get paid this summer and looking pretty good, you know, coming off a tough injury. And it just sucks that he's not going to get that chance to really prove himself. And he maybe has to go through another year trying to do that. But in terms of these two teams, like this is kind of what they are, right? The Warriors are great, and then they kind of lose focus, and then usually their talent allows them to keep getting those wins, but it just didn't last night. And the Clippers have come back from, like, three or four 20-point deficits in second half this year and done an incredible job of it. It's usually Lou Williams just getting hot and carving up a defense.
I wonder what that makes the Milwaukee Bucks think right now, who are sort of the consensus second favorite, perhaps, to win the NBA championship. Do they look at this and say, you know what, with all of our star-crossed injury luck, with Gasol going down, Nico going down, Brogdon still dealing with the plantar fasciitis, that maybe it's like, look, maybe we're finally catching a break here that we might have a better chance than once thought.
Yeah, and I think too, like with Milwaukee, as long, you know, as they get deeper into the playoffs, which obviously has been an issue in the past, but I think this year we can expect them to get past a Blake Griffin-less.
Oh my God, they're awful! I mean, that's not watchable.
Like, let's just have them scrimmage, right? Like, let's just have the Bucks scrimmage at this point. That would be more entertaining to see those guys go out there and just do a practice rather than watch these games. But yeah, I think as Milwaukee gets deeper in the playoffs, assuming no one else gets injured, they get healthier, and Brogdon can come back, and Mirotić can come back, and they can, you know, they can kind of shore up that rotation. And then if they can get those guys in game shape by, let's say, end of the second round conference finals, it's a pretty dangerous team if they can keep making it past everyone else. But you have to get past Boston. You have to get past either Toronto or Philadelphia. You know, and then once you get there, you have to get to the Warriors, and you have to have enough energy, enough focus, enough talent, and enough luck in order to take them down. Like, I don't know. Like, that seems like a lot for their first real foray and deep into the playoffs.
So, Zach, I think I need a little psychological help. Well, a lot, really, but only a little with the NBA playoffs. I'm looking for
I'm a doctor. I can handle it.
Oh, perfect. Great. This is great timing. Because I'm watching the first round here, and because of, you know, not to say that there hasn't been some pretty decent games to watch. We just talked about the comeback that was. The watching the Warriors, there's kind of this impending sense of what Kevin Durant does, and if the whole thing ends, and in Boston it's the same thing with Kyrie. There's just with Kawhi in Toronto, there's the same thing. There's just kind of this impending sense of it's all going to change after this few weeks, and it hangs over me a little. I wonder what I'm supposed to do with that, if anything.
Well, I like to look at all this like kind of we know what's going to happen, right? Like, we know the Warriors are going to win the title, or at least we're pretty sure. We know that Kevin Durant is going to leave, at least we're pretty sure. We know Kyrie's weird, right? That we're 100% sure of. You know, and Kawhi, it seems pretty certain that he's going to go to the Clippers. Like, I don't know. Like, that seems to be all the rumblings around. Like, no matter what happens, he goes to the Clippers. I never know what to do with that stuff, but those rumblings that usually last a long time end up being true. I like to look at it as, I watched Skyscraper, the Rock movie, right?
Okay.
I knew how it was going to end. I knew he was going to save the day. I knew, despite his limitations with the prosthetic leg, that leg was going to save him at one point.
Spoiler alert! Come on, spoilers!
I knew all this. Oh, that was, it's a year old. I knew all this stuff was going to happen, and yet I enjoyed the hell out of it. Like, you have all these like overhanging cloudy things that are going to, you know, maybe say like, oh, well, I know what's going to happen here, but because we know the Warriors are going to win, and then chaos is going to, you know, reign supreme in free agency, that almost seems like a better buildup to me.
Yeah, the difference between the dramatic irony that you describe is that when the listener or viewer becomes aware of something foreshadowed that the character does not, these characters we're talking about actually have free will. That it's not, right. It's not a script. It's not something that's already that these things, the fun of it, I think, is that it actually could change at the 11th hour.
Well, also, like, Kevin Durant's a moody guy, right? Like, one of my favorite tweets, came from this guy, Dragonfly Jones, who everyone should follow on Twitter. He's hilarious. But it was after KD called out my colleague and friend Ethan Strauss, basically saying, like, oh, you don't come around here, you don't say anything, you wrote this thing about me going to New York, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the tweet was, do I think Kevin Durant has all these plans, and yet in order to prove one right or wrong, he will change everything just to be petty and prove a point? Yeah, absolutely. I think that'll happen. Like, that seems to be the type of person Kevin Durant is, right? Like, he has all these plans to go to the Knicks, and then all of a sudden he decides, oh, I don't like the way they're talking about me. I'm going to prove them that they're wrong. They don't know that this thing I've you know, planned out is actually going to happen. Like, I think Kevin Durant is so moody and so sensitive with a lot of this stuff that you never know what's going to happen. Like, when they make it to the finals, there's not a chance in hell he lets Steph Curry get close to a finals MVP. Like, it's just little dramatic things like that where, yeah, it's not scripted, but it's kind of scripted because we know these personalities well enough.
What will make Rockets-Warriors feel different this year than last?
I think there's a confidence in the Rockets. Now, I think it's a little misplaced. And some of it comes because James Harden is just on the level he wasn't last year. He's on a level that is, I mean, it's historic, right? Like, what he's doing, only a couple other people in the history of this game have done. And so I think that because of that, there is this confidence that they can overcome everything. They really believe, hey, we were a Chris Paul hamstring away from being NBA champions last year. Like, they really believe that. And some people agree. I don't. I think they were always going to lose that series no matter what. But they really believe that. That going into it adds a chippiness. It makes them like a team of Patrick Beverleys out there, where they are going to jaw at the Warriors. They're going to get in their face. They're going to hit threes and celebrate in their face. Like, they are going to do everything because they're legitimately unfazed by the Warriors. Now, the Warriors have more talent, and the Warriors should be able to handle them enough because the Rockets have struggled quite a bit defensively, even though the second half of the season was better for them. But in terms of just, like, the personality and the attitude going into it, their mindset is pretty spectacular. Last year, I think they were kind of feeling that out. This year, they go into it very confident, probably too confident.
When does it matter that the Sixers bench kind of sucks?
Ooh, when Boban's not hitting jumpers, right? Like, that seemed to be the difference last night. You see this lamppost, like, shooting jumpers at the free throw line, and you're trying to figure out why that's happening. But other than that, like, James Ennis, Mike Scott, TJ McConnell, like, these are fine players to get you through, you know, a game against the Hornets in March. But when you have to take down actual teams, and they have to go against Toronto in the next round, man, that bench sucks. Like, that bench just isn't good. And the problem with that is you can stagger it, right? Like, their starting lineup is actually should be their depth, because you can have three of those guys on the floor at all times, assuming they're all healthy. And by all of them, I mean Joel Embiid. But assuming those guys are healthy, like, you can have three of those guys on the floor at all time, and it minimizes how much you need from your bench. But, man, like, at a certain point, Brett Brown has to do a better job with rotations and a better job with their attack overall, because, yeah, they corrected things last night. They you know, blew them out in the second half. But that Brooklyn team isn't going to be fazed by that either. That Brooklyn team is going to come back, and Caris LeVert's going to say, TJ McConnell, like, yeah, I can take that guy. Are you kidding me? Look at him. He looks like an accountant.
Before we let you go, Zach Harper, recent reports indicate the Bulls are willing, if not intending, to extend Jim Boylan's contract again. We're not quite sure why they feel compelled to do this. I'm serious. I know you're laughing, but we laugh to keep from crying, because I don't get it. Do you have any insight into why this administration would seek to extend Jim Boylan's deal already?
You know, somebody asked me that a few weeks ago, saying, like, hey, have you heard anything on the Chicago front? I was like, look, I don't feel confident enough with this information to report it, but yeah, it sounds like they're going to keep him. Right. And the person just responded, the person with the Bulls fan, they said, my God, I hope you're wrong. And I said, me too. And it turns out it looks like it's right. And it's just, I don't know if it's a comfort thing, you know, like it feels like you went and you bought all these groceries to make this incredible meal. And then on your way home, you like passed a Taco Bell and were just like, oh, a burrito sounds great right now. And so now you just leave all these groceries in the fridge, and then you forget about them, and they expire. Like, that's what it feels like. That's what this feels like with Jim Boylan. Like, he might be a good coach, or an adequate quote. It doesn't seem like he's the right guy for this, although it doesn't seem like most of what they're doing is the right fit for anything. Like, none of this, all these moves individually seem justifiable. But when you put them all together, you're like, what the hell is this puzzle? Like, this puzzle doesn't mean anything. And so I just feel like it's comfortable. Jim Boylan is comfortable. They're comfortable with him. He's good enough for them right now in their minds, and that's good enough for them.
Zach, thank you. And also, thank you for the most relatable metaphor I have heard in weeks.
Everybody's nodding along.
I thought,
what am I doing?
Oh, God. I have bought that burrito so many times.
Zach, thank you, sir.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Zach Harper of The Athletic on Twitter, @TalkHoops. The top of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Nothing beats playoff hockey in Chicago. Catch your Central Division champion Chicago Wolves as they battle Grand Rapids in the first round Friday and Saturday night at 7 at Allstate Arena. For playoff information, visit ChicagoWolves.com. We have a former Cubs great, good in the news, who is not done playing baseball in Chicago. It's a
comeback kid.
It's a strange story. We're going to get to it. Also, in just a moment, I'm going to tell you why, if you shop where I shop, you might get free stuff.
Free stuff.
This is not a station promotion. This is a me thing.
Dan's out on a limb.
I figured something out. I've decided to do something here, and I just had sort of an epiphany, and you may be the beneficiary of it.
Why would you go anywhere? Dan's got free stuff. It's Bernstein McKnight, 670 The Score.